So I ran down, managed to get into that corridor as Michael Noonan was entering it, having left the chamber. And I went up to him and I said, like, you don't know who I am. My name is Peter Murphy. I'm a reporter for the Irish Times. I have reason to believe that the outgoing government was illegally tapping the phones of journalists. I think documentary evidence exists in the Department of Justice. You know, will you check it out for me? Can I talk to you later? And he told me much later, after this event, that he nearly wet his pants.
For over 40 years, Peter Murta has been prominent in Irish and British journalism, winning many awards and occupying a variety of senior roles along the way. Starting as a student editor of the Trinity News, he freelanced for a while and then got a job in the Irish Times, where he quickly made his name as security correspondent. Murta and a political reporter colleague, Joe Joyce, co-wrote The Boss, a drama-filled account of Charles Haughey's minority Fianna Fáil government, which ruled for 9 months in 1982. They also wrote Blind Justice, about Ireland's great train robbery in 1976. He's also written The Rape of Greece, a book about the seven-year rule of a military junta. And if all that wasn't enough, he's written two travel books, one with his daughter Natasha about walking the Camino, and recently, Tip to Top, an account of a motorbike trip from southernmost Chile to Alaska's most northerly point. Peter Murta, it's great to have you here for the Insights podcast. I see you're still wearing your motorbike gear and it's parked outside. One could be forgiven for thinking you're mainly an author of books, but much more than that, you're a journalist first and foremost. What drew you to the trade?
Oh, I suppose an innate curiosity. I think if I try to recall my teenage years, which are now in the distant past, I would recall poking my nose into places and asking questions just in a sort of childish, curious way, and sometimes to the embarrassment of my parents. But I was always interested just in other people, like, and who are you and where are you from and, you know, what are you up to and what's going on and why did such and such a happen? So that innate curiosity about the world, about me, has always been part of my personality, if you like.
And you packed so much in. I mean, one of the many things that struck me about your career reading the notes is how you moved about. The Boss was an absolute page-turner, and the stories you worked on around that period were astonishing. 1982, an astonishing year, of course, in Irish politics. Two general elections, leadership heaves in Fianna Fáil, the infamous location of a double killer in the Attorney General's apartment, the witness to a court case in this jurisdiction mysteriously lifted by the RUC in order to stop him giving evidence against the Minister for Justice's brother-in-law, an effort to transfer maybe an overly conscientious sergeant in the Minister's constituency, phone tapping by the state of two prominent political journalists, a minister secretly recording a conversation with a party colleague. I mean, it just beggars belief. Nothing like it, I think, before.
It's a bit like
since.
A sort of Netflix plot, isn't it, for a series?
Yeah, it's a wonder there has hasn't been one made of it, actually. Yeah, but I mean, after that momentous year, I mean, was it all kind of downhill after that for you? Because very quickly, you actually set your sights on going to London.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, to go maybe back just in the run up to all that, I mean, my ambition, and once I knew kind of what I wanted to do, which was in those early college years, I wanted to be a journalist, I wanted to be a reporter. My sights at that time were to be a reporter in the Irish Times. That was like the unattainable dream. And, I was fortunate enough to land a job there. And
you only wanted to be, I mean, I was going to be the editor of the Irish Times. It didn't happen, but
I wanted that later when I lost the run of myself. But no, to be a reporter in the Irish Times was an enormous dream for me as a young person. And look, it happened, and that was fantastic, and I was very grateful. And it was unusual to leave the Irish Times. I mean, you will know from your career, RT is top of the food chain, Irish Times is top of the food chain in their respective arenas.
Having spent 10 years working for the Irish Press Group, I might just
beg
to differ.
You
know, the best newsroom in Dublin.
Well, you were always our rivals. You know, when I was there as a reporter in the newsroom in the Times, the one that we watched like a hawk was the Press.
Well, unlike the Independent, you had the decency not to lift our stories, but that's another story.
So getting to the Irish Times and then leaving it, I think, was quite unusual. And what happened was, yes, in 1982 it happened, and lots of other stories, and I'd had, you know, a certain amount of success, and that was very professionally gratifying. And the Brighton bombing happened, and I was sent over to cover that by Conor O'Clery, who was the news editor in the Times. And when I was there, I met a fellow named Patrick Bishop, who had been to Dublin a number of times. He, at that stage, was working for, I think, the Times of London. And we were a little bit friendly in the way reporters are. He'd come to Dublin, ask me, you know, for a bit of guidance and what have you. And so I was doing the same with him. And I just said to him, look, any jobs going in your place? I'm a bit restless. I wouldn't mind, you know, spreading my wings. And soon after that, the then editor of the Sunday Times Insight team, whose name was Paul Eddy, he contacted me, and he also knew me from coming over to Dublin to work on stories. And he said, look, I'm giving up the role as editor of Insight. Would you be interested? And to be honest, to have somebody say to you at that time, I mean, the Insight team at the Sunday Times then was absolutely the gold standard of investigative journalism.
Was it by Harold Evans?
Set up by Harold Evans, absolutely, and had an enormous series of medals on its chest, if you like, perhaps the biggest being the thalidomide story. And the idea of going over to work in such a paper and to lead such a team was a temptation too great.
And they did brilliant stuff on Northern Ireland as well. Look, we'll come back to the Insight team, but just coming back then to your work in the Irish Times and that particular period in 1982 especially, I mean, there was a huge atmosphere of distrust, I think. People were very careful about who they talked to in politics. Yeah. You even had concerns of your own, did you?
Well, yeah, at one stage, I mean, it seems like sort of silly paranoia looking back all these years. But you're right, there was an atmosphere throughout the summer and the autumn of 1982. And I, at that time, had got my first house, which was a very run-down, not quite semi-derelict, little cottage in Killancarrig in North County Wicklow. And there was no hot water and there was no sewage and all the rest of it. And I was doing it up bit by bit. And the next door place was also unoccupied. And I got it into my head one evening that I could hear something going on next door. And I was a bit anxious about this. And at this stage, I think I knew about the phone tapping, but I hadn't written it. And I did ask a guard colleague, look, you know, is there any way this could be checked out or should I be concerned about this? And I think somebody did inspect this house and came back to me and said, look, there's nothing in there. There's nothing happening. You know, you are being paranoid. and everything was fine. But you're right. I mean, Geraldine Kennedy has spoken of the time, I think it was around Suffolk Street or Trinity Street. And a broken bottle or a broken glass was left in her windscreen, communicating some sort of message of, you know, back off and all of that. So there was a bit of that. I mean, I would hate to think if 1982 happened now, what it would be like with social media and with the amount of anger that you see abroad today related to politics and people's passions.
For people who maybe have forgotten or who never heard or who weren't even born at that time. Yeah. I mean, the phone tapping.
Yeah.
It was, I suppose, one of the outstanding features of that particular year. And it wasn't just the phone tapping of journalists, was it? I mean, there were, well, most prominently Geraldine Kennedy and Bruce Arnold. Yeah. Bruce, of course, having died quite recently.
Indeed, yes. There were a couple of other people that emerged, subsequent to that. I think Vincent Brown was one of them. And look, I heard about it, I think, round about September of 82. And there were a couple of interesting things about learning it. One was the source says, you know, this has to come out in the Irish Times because the Irish Times is the paper that it will be believed if it's reported there. And the other thing was, back to the paranoia, we set up names. I had to ring a number and I had to ask for somebody called Philomena. And that would indicate that I wanted a meeting with the sources. And that went on for a little while. And so I got to the point where I was satisfied this was true. I was satisfied it was happening. The question was then how to report it and when to report it, more's the point. And so because I knew if it was reported under certain circumstances, evidence would disappear as to the truth of what I was reporting. And so it would just remain there as one of those stories that, well, who knows if it's true, you know? So I had to wait until after a general election, which I think the government collapsed around about November 82, and there was an election and Fianna Fáil and Mr. Haughey lost that election. And so on December the 18th, the Irish Times ran the story on the front page. And one of the interesting things, I think, looking back and thinking about how journalism is practiced today, was the story was very short. It was about six paragraphs. It wasn't a huge, you know, shouting from the rooftops, screaming headline or anything like that. It was a very short story. But of course, the proverbial hit the fan when that came out. And there were a couple of others in the paper at the same time. There was a story about Tom Tully, who was a sergeant up in Roscommon, Leitrim area, who was being moved unjustly by the Minister for Justice. And then there was the story of the Dara affair, if you want to go into that, an extraordinarily complex conspiracy involving essentially a conspiracy between police in Northern Ireland, police in the Republic, to kidnap a man in Northern Ireland to pervert the course of justice in the Republic.
Well, I refer to that in the intro, that he was due to give evidence in district court against the brother-in-law of the then Justice Minister, Sean Doherty.
Correct. And he lived in Northern Ireland, and on the morning that he was due to leave his house and cross the border and go to the court in Dara and give evidence of this alleged incident, he was arrested for no reason.
Might there have been an element, I mean, you were saying, look, you know, you decided not to publish, but presumably you were in consultation. Was Douglas Gageby then the editor of the paper?
He was.
Now, he, I think, if memory serves me right, he would have been fairly well disposed towards Charles Haughey, who would have been the outgoing Taoiseach. I mean, might there have been an element of him saying, look, this could have too heavy an influence, or it might change the course of the election or something like that? Was there a caution, maybe an abundance or overabundance of caution?
Well, as the saying goes, you can say that, Mr. O'Rourke, but I couldn't possibly comment. But it was difficult. I mean, I think it's well known that Douglas Gageby had a great respect for uniforms and had a great respect, quite correctly, for Garda Síochána and the Defence Forces. He had served in the Defence Forces himself, and he had an affection for them. John Healy, who was a very famous columnist in the Irish Times, wrote a political column every week called Backbencher, which was absolutely compulsive reading. And John Healy was kind of chief cheerleader of the Charles Haughey fan club.
It wasn't a very big fan club in the Irish Times, though, let's be fair.
It possibly wasn't in the Irish Times, but John Healy was very, very close to Douglas Gageby. And I suspect he influenced Gageby in his approach to Haughey stories. And yes, Gageby was cautious, I would have think overly cautious. And I think there was an element of perhaps not wanting certain stories to be true, or finding them like just incredible, which of course they were, but they were true.
Anyway, the whole thing came right out into the open, along with a lot of other stuff, because the new government, in which Gareth Fitzgerald was Taoiseach, Michael Noonan, Minister for Justice, they set up an inquiry.
They did. I mean, in the lead up to that, I mean, there's a funny story to that, if you like, that you will know from after elections, when the Dáil resumes, there is that moment when there is the nominations for Taoiseach, and the Taoiseach is voted by the Dáil and is appointed. And then the Taoiseach goes to the president, gets the seal of office and comes back to Leinster House and appoints the cabinet. I was in the press gallery for that. And as soon as Gareth Fitzgerald announced that the new Minister for Justice is Michael Noonan, I didn't know who Michael Noonan was. He was then quite a young TD and largely unknown, certainly to me, not a political reporter. So I left the press gallery, and behind the chamber in Leinster House, which is kind of bow-shaped, it's a horseshoe-shaped chamber, and behind that curve, there's a corridor, and everybody piles into that corridor and they move about wherever it is they want to go when the chamber rises. So I ran down, managed to get into that corridor as Michael Noonan was entering it, having left the chamber. And I went up to him and I said, like, you don't know who I am. My name is Peter Murta. I'm a reporter for the Irish Times. I have reason to believe that the outgoing government was illegally tapping the phones of journalists. I think documentary evidence exists in the Department of Justice. You know, will you check it out for me? Can I talk to you later? And he told me much later after this event that he nearly wet his pants, because he had been told about the tapping by Gareth Fitzgerald, I think the evening before or maybe that morning. And Gareth more or less told him in terms of, you know, you have to check this out, Michael. It's top secret. Nobody knows this. It's extraordinarily serious, a threat to the state, democracy, blah, blah, blah. And here was this young hack whom he didn't know running up to him saying, listen, come here, can you check this out for me?
Well, obviously, Gareth Fitzgerald wasn't your source.
No, he was not. And no, he was not. He was not. But somebody obviously had told him about it. And he acted. And Michael Noonan did, to his great credit, have a very deep investigation and came out with a report which was published in full, as far as I'm aware, and which was extraordinary in the detail it revealed about the tapping and also how Ray McSherry had used bugging equipment obtained from the Gardaí for him by Sean Doherty to secretly tape record his cabinet colleague, Martin O'Donoghue. I mean, extraordinary stuff, really quite extraordinary. Just by the by, one of the largely unknown and unsung heroes of that episode, in my view anyway, was a Department of Justice official named Jim Kirby. And Jim Kirby was the man who processed the warrants to tap the telephones of Bruce Arnold and Geraldine Kennedy. And he raised objections and he strongly opposed this with the minister, knowing that it was improper, if not illegal. And Jim Kirby ensured that a documentary trail existed when the minister overruled him, that a documentary trail existed so that this improper state power and improper conduct by a government would not be buried and could be proven. And you know, his name is unknown. He was a quiet man. He retired some years ago and he died just a few days ago. And he really is one of the unsung heroes of an episode that I think really was a threat to
our
democracy.
Was he a man who would talk to journalists on the quiet?
I don't know. She possibly did.
Okay.
I don't know. All I will say, I certainly did not know him at that time. I didn't know him during
But he does get mentioned in your book, but I suppose that came later, that kind of information in The Boss. There's fantastic detail about all of that period in The Boss. Well worth reading or rereading indeed.
Thank you.
The other book that you wrote was Blind Justice. Now, that was about the Salins mail train robbery, when I think it was the biggest robbery in the history of the state at that stage, something about £250,000 in old notes were taken and certain people were picked up who had associations with the IRSP, the Irish Republican Socialist Party. And there were suggestions at the time, and I think the way Gareth Fitzgerald described it in his book, without actually referring specifically to that, but that he had been approached by some Gardaí in mid-February 1977, which was towards the end of that government's life, that coalition government which was elected in 73. Gardaí were concerned about confessions extracted by improper methods. And that was at the kernel of that book, wasn't it?
It was. That was the allegation, all right. I mean, it was. There were a number of cases at that time that caught the attention of Amnesty International and the Irish Council for Civil Liberties and what have you. And essentially, the problem was prosecutions that were being based solely on confessions made in custody. And this was before recordings and cameras and all that sort of, all those sort of checks and balances. And I suppose what one can say is that the level of allegations were at a particular pitch that they really couldn't be ignored. And that sort of, that allegation about how the police investigated crimes is central to the Salins case and to the people who were arrested. And it went on for many years. Oscar Brannock was one of the people concerned, Brian McNally, and of course the Labour Party councillor down in Arklow, Nicky Kelly. He became a Labour councillor. And the Nicky Kelly case went on for an awful long time because he found himself in a kind of legal black hole when the others...
He was, I think, released by Michael Noonan, but much later when Pádraig Flynn was Minister for Justice, I think he was given an apology, was he not?
He was. I'm pretty sure he got a state apology, a pardon. The slate was wiped clean anyway. He was an innocent man and he was wrongly convicted, as were the others. But the others... And Kelly's problem was that he jumped bail. After conviction, he was on bail and he jumped bail and went to the United States. The others stayed here, were sent to prison, but appealed from prison, won their appeal. So they were freed. And he was in this kind of legal black hole where he came home after their successful appeal. And of course, the system says, well, hang on a second now. First item on the agenda is you jumped bail and you have this conviction to serve. So he went back into prison and was in a, as I say, a legal black hole for some time before eventually governments did move. And
one of the points that you brought out in that book was how Nicky Kelly was said in Garda evidence to have pointed out a particular house where, you know, it led down the trail, I think, towards the scene of the robbery. But there was a problem about that piece of evidence.
Yeah, the problem was when we did as much checking as we could. We based the book largely on the court transcripts and retelling that story. But we would go back and check as much. And yes, in evidence, it was said sort of, well, we knew where the robbery had taken place because it was just past the second house on the left or whatever exactly was said. And of course, we went back and checked, and that house wasn't built at the time of the robbery. So how could you say this in evidence?
This was quite a hole to blow in the story.
We thought so.
Yeah. So then other horizons, off to London with you to head up the insights team. Mm. It was an interesting, not to say a very turbulent time in journalism in Britain for all sorts of reasons. It was no longer the old Harold Evans Sunday Times. Well, I think he may have initially moved anyway to be editor of the daily paper, the Times. Yeah. Rupert Murdoch was by then the owner, was he not?
He was indeed the owner. And I suppose the whole episode, which was, it didn't work for either side, as they say, is evidence of my own naivety or not thinking things through. I found the culture shock overwhelming and disturbing. The Sunday Times was very, very different in terms of its values, its standards, how it did things than what I was used to or what I expected. And I think there was an awful lot of manipulation of the news. One incident, a colleague under my direction was investigating a bank, a particular bank story, and he had a snippet of information enough to make a news story on this, and so he wrote it, and we sent it through the system and noticed that a more senior executive demanded another reporter ring up the Conservative Party, get some particular quote knocking the story down, and put that at the top of the story. That sort of manipulation absolutely shocked me that anybody would do that. So despite having some fun there and some being involved, a couple of good stories, notably investigating cocaine in the Caribbean and in relation to Sir Lyndon Oscar Pindling, who was Prime Minister of the Bahamas and working a lot with the DEA out of Miami. It was just, extraordinary, and doing that for many months. Despite all of that, when in the, I think it was the autumn of 85, I think, when Murdoch had secretly created a parallel newspaper production operation and overnight moved the entire Times and Sunday Times to a new site with new technology, and in the process sacked several thousand people. And I just thought this was morally appalling. And so a number of us, about 20 or 30 of us, refused to go.
That was the famous move to Wapping. It was the beginning of the end of Fleet Street, as it was then known.
It was. And I suppose in retrospect, it was a fantastic advance. New technology has been wonderfully liberating for journalism in the sense of going from hot metal to computers and all of that. But I just personally, I could not. I felt I just couldn't work for people who would sack thousands of people.
But you argue that it was a morally unjustifiable move. But I mean, weren't there morally unjustifiable practices going on in Fleet Street?
There were, of course,
at the hands of the unions. I mean, Simon Jenkins, I think, famously
Spanish
wrote a book about like ghost employees.
Yes,
It became such a joke that there were names like M. Mouse. Being paid.
All true. That's all true. And the print unions behaved appallingly at times. But library assistants, secretaries, cleaners of the office, these people weren't
happened to you in the end? I mean, you were a small number of holdouts.
We were known as the Refuseniks. And we kept going into the old offices in Gray's Inn Road for, I think, probably a month. I can't actually remember at this stage. And it was clear that this was, hopeless, as these things usually are. And I had a couple of connections into The Guardian, not least through Joe Joyce.
Were you sacked then, or what happened?
Ultimately, yes, I was sacked. I think, legally, technically, I was sacked, but the actual sacking, I think, probably happened, 6 months or a year later. And we were paid compensation. We were all paid, I think it was £1,000.
It was nearly the size of a government grant to buy a house at that stage back home. But Andrew Neil, I think, was the editor at that stage. You didn't really hit it off with him, did you?
No, I mean, look, I was a small fish in a big pond. But no, I didn't like what I saw, and I didn't like a lot of the tone. And one person in there, one of his more senior executives, said to me one day that they weren't interested in victim stories. And this was because, like, you know, there are no victims in Mrs. Thatcher's Britain, that this is the way forward. They were absolutely pro the then Conservative government and very anti-trade union. And, you know, I can understand all of that, but to me, this is not what journalism is about. You know, a newspaper can have a view, but it's not the role of journalists to act in a way that supports that view.
The Guardian was a much happier hunting ground for you, was it?
It was, and I was very, very, very lucky. As I say, Joe Joyce, my old partner in crime, was able to effect an introduction for me to them. And they said, yeah, you know, come in, we'll give you a couple of shifts. And they did give me a couple of shifts, and basically I never left the place. About 2 or 3 or 4 weeks later, I was put on staff and largely had a very, very, very happy time there. And I felt at home again. I felt I was with people who shared my values, both in terms of my personal outlook, but also, perhaps more importantly, in terms of what journalism is about.
Which brings us, I suppose, to the Stalker affair. That was a story that you pursued about the, I think he was the chief constable in Manchester, or Greater Manchester, John Stalker, who was assigned to investigate allegations of a shoot-to-kill policy by the RUC in yeah. Northern Ireland in the 1980s.
Yes. Yes, John Stalker, he was deputy chief constable, probably should have been chief constable at one stage, given his standing and his career. He was indeed appointed. There were a number of incidents in Northern Ireland. The allegation was that the authorities, the security forces, police and military were operating a, quote, shoot-to-kill policy, unquote. And he was assigned to investigate. And he investigated, I think it was 4 or 5 very specific incidents. And it was known that kind of that story was going on, that this inquiry was taking place. And, you know, anybody who's interested in Northern Ireland wondered, well, when will the Stalker report come out, kind of thing. It wasn't in the headlines. It wasn't a running story as such. And then one day it's announced that Stalker has been suspended. He's been removed as head of the inquiry. He has been suspended as deputy chief constable of Greater Manchester and is himself under investigation. So, like, talk about things hitting the fan, you know. And because I was Irish and because I had an amount of experience in Northern Ireland, I was asked to, you know, have a sniff around this story and see what I could find out. And so I did spend probably 2 or 3 or 4 months doing just that.
What did you find out?
I found out that at the core of the story was an allegation that a slightly colourful Manchester businessman, the north of England is a place, they've got a phrase up there called where there's muck, there's brass. So it's there's a lot of hard working industry up there. There's a rough and tumble to business in the north of England. That's kind of the stereotype, if you like. And Kevin Taylor, who's the businessman, was a muck and brass fella, sort of rough around the edges, but perfectly honest, perfectly good, very colourful character. And yes, he happened to be a pal of John Stalker. So the allegation was there was something improper in this friendship. There wasn't, but that was the allegation.
What do you think lay behind the suspension of Stalker, the real reason?
It's very hard to say. All I can say is what I found out. So there was the whole Kevin Taylor aspect of it, so that's fine. And a deputy chief constable of another constabulary was appointed to investigate that allegedly improper relationship. Meanwhile, the actual Stalker inquiry itself, what was going on there? And what was going on was that one of the incidents that Stalker was investigating was known as the Hay Shed shooting, where a couple of young lads, one of them Michael Tye, were shot dead in a disused barn, if memory serves me right, in Armagh. And inside the barn, it was found that there were a couple of clapped out rifles, possibly not capable of being fired. So, if you like, the official version of this event was a couple of terrorists were found with weapons and they were shot when confronted by security forces. What Stalker found out was that the barn had been bugged and there was a tape. And the tape was either made by MI5 or possessed by MI5. I can't at this remove actually recall. But he wanted to get that tape because that tape, clearly, if it was of sufficient quality, would tend to corroborate one or other version of events. And he was trying to get this. And Jack Herman, Sir John Herman, who was chief constable of the RUC at the time, was digging his heels in and refusing to hand it over. To the best of my knowledge, MI5 were relaxed about the tape being handed over. They weren't bothered. But it was at the point where I think Stalker was going back to Herman with that information that, listen, you're saying I can't have this, but the people who made the tape and who therefore have some sort of ownership of it, they're happy that I get it. Now I want it. And it was at that point that he was removed.
Very interesting. Again, John Stalker has published his own account of all these events. Now, you stayed in the garage for a few years, but then you came back to Dublin. The lure of an editor's chair.
Well, after all of this in The Guardian, I kind of I changed horses by going from reporting into editorial commissioning management roles. So I became deputy foreign editor and then news editor. And an opportunity arose here, or a vacancy arose. Vincent Brown was editor of the Sunday Tribune, and he and they parted company rather acrimoniously. And so there was a vacancy, and I applied and got it. And that was in sort of late winter, early spring of 94, and came home dragging a recently acquired wife, Moira, who's from South Hertfordshire, and our two children, Patrick and Natasha, both who were born.
Again, thanks to The Guardian, am I right in thinking?
Yes, Moira worked for The Guardian. She wasn't on the journalistic side, but on the admin side. She was PA to Peter Preston, who became a friend of both of us. And, you know, she had had a very, very fulfilling career, 20 years there, working for the chairman, for the MD and for the editor, and absolutely adored it. And in as much as somebody who isn't a journalist but can have that huge understanding about what we're like and what journalism is like, she has that. So yes, we got married and we had two children over there. And when we came home to Ireland, as it were, home for me, Patrick was 4, Natasha was 2. So it was, if I was going to kind of impose a move on the family, it was a good time in that they were, Patrick was about to go to primary school. And that helped Moira a lot, that she immediately had a circle, because she became a stay-at-home mum after the children arrived. And so she had an entree to friends here.
Editing the Sunday Tribune like?
Difficult. It was exciting. It was exhilarating at times. It was professionally very satisfying at times. But yes, it was difficult, because they were difficult times and the Tribune was struggling, kind of as it always had really struggled. It was very successful under Conor Brady, successful also under Vincent. Less successful for me, I think we had some good days and we had some good additions, and I think I maybe stabilised the situation, because I think a lot of the staff were kind of punch drunk when I arrived. And I was there for about 2.5 years, and, you know, we just couldn't kind of climb out of the slump we were in. There was a small increase in circulation, and then it kind of went back into the sort of slouch where it was. I think it was the late 70s, early 80s in terms of weekly sales, something like that.
80,000.
You'd
take it now?
Oh, you would, absolutely. I think when I came, it might have been 79.75, and it went to 81 or something, and then it went back to 80. So, you know, I didn't have the impact I certainly would have hoped, would have liked to have had, but did the best I could, but, it wasn't good enough.
Yeah, and then you went back to the Irish Times, and you had a succession of editorial positions there. And, Peter, you must have spent about 60% of your career as a journalist, or thereabouts, in management.
Yeah, probably looking back, probably more than I should have, really. But when I went back, Conor Brady was editor and I was an assistant editor, and he gave me responsibility for the Saturday news features, which I really enjoyed. And I think it was 4 pages in the main paper, and then it was merged into what is now the weekend section, and it's still there. And that was very satisfying. And then I was foreign editor, I was an op-ed editor, and then a managing editor. And there was a succession of chief editors, Connor, then Geraldine Kennedy, and Kevin O'Sullivan, Paul O'Neill, and now my last editor was Ruan McCormick, who is the current editor.
Was there a part of you all along that itched to get back on the road?
Sometimes, yes. It wasn't overwhelming, funnily enough. Mm. You know, I kind of have these reflections now that if I was doing it again, I perhaps wouldn't stay as long in management as I did. I liked it. I got great pleasure out of it. It was really rewarding to direct other people and to kind of oversee the production of pages and
maybe nurture some careers and some talent as well.
Maybe. I mean, they'd have to say that. But I certainly liked spotting younger people who I thought, you know, had great gift and giving them a leg up, you know. That was satisfying, yes. But what I did do was when I think it was Kevin O'Sullivan was editor, I had about 6 years to go maybe. And I thought I'd like to go back to reporting. So I went to Kevin and said, look, it was shortly after he'd been appointed, I think a few months. And I said, you know, you've got your feet under the desk now and you know, best wishes and all the rest of it. I would fancy moving back to reporting if you want to rearrange the deck chairs and down into the newsroom. And he was a bit startled at that because that nobody had done that before, as far as I'm aware. And he didn't do it immediately, but in due course, he said, OK, look, we can do that now. So I went back down into the newsroom and I was very determined that I should have no title and I would just be a reporter. I feared that that might be a bit awkward for some people, particularly people on the news desk, you know, people whom I might have been asking to do things beforehand in a more senior position. Now I was under them. And I didn't want anybody to feel that. So initially I started doing kind of the lowest, the most menial tasks for the news desk just to indicate, you know.
You weren't going to be bigfooting your way through the newsroom.
No, I'd hate that to be thought of me. And I hope nobody did at that time. I just wanted to be a hack again and to be thrown at stories as they emerged.
And you spent a considerable time profiling Dennis O'Brien in a particular, I think it got you an award as Investigative Journalist of the Year, yeah, in about 2016 or thereabouts. He had a particular battle against a group of people who had previously been in The Independent, yeah, with him when he was the owner, and then they had gone into PR or public affairs.
Yeah. Yes, it was an extraordinary story. It was kind of a proxy battle in a way for what was going on in independent newspapers. Dennis O'Brien had bought an interest in independent newspapers when it was controlled still by Tony O'Reilly and his allies and associates. And gradually O'Brien sort of increased his holding to the point where he could take over. And so the court case concerned Mr. O'Brien and Red Flag Consulting, which was run by Carl Brophy, and also Tony O'Reilly's son, Gavin, was involved. And in a way, the row between Mr. O'Brien and Red Flag and Gavin and Carl and that was a proxy battle for what had been happening earlier, because both of them had been involved in I&M. And it was a rather, you know, it was an extraordinary story and the sort of stuff that was coming out in the court case. And of course, the information that was coming out was leads to be followed, which I did with a certain enthusiasm, because it was just hilarious. The story of memory sticks and a character in the Netherlands analysing the memory stick and all sorts of employees with unbelievable names and numbers and what have you. It was quite bizarre.
And required a certain amount of editorial caution and I would say legal oversight as well.
Yeah, I mean, the paper was quite rightly, and I hope I was too, cautious and careful and making sure that there were multiple sources for stories and that the evidence was there and could be produced in court, etc., etc. And the Irish Times, I've always found, has always taken its responsibilities seriously, you know, without anybody externally, without being in fear of anybody externally. It's a kind of self-imposed thing that, you know, we the Irish Times have certain standards. I'm sure this is the same in RTE. We have standards and these are our standards. These are our values and we will adhere to them. And certainly, you know, not writing knowingly false things about anybody, not double checking, not putting an allegation to somebody if you're going to put it in print. All of those things are there and they're part of the normal course. And yes, lawyers were breathing down my neck, helpfully, I say.
I want to go back to the books. And before I talk about the travel ones, what prompted you to write The Rape of Greece?
That goes back to when I was in The Guardian, and I was quite pally with Peter Preston, and he knew a fellow named Martin Packard. And Martin Packard was one of these extraordinary individuals thrown up in life at various stages. He had been a lieutenant commander in the Royal Navy, and then he got into business. And he had done certain things. He was a social democrat and an activist kind of a fellow. And when his wife was Greek-British, her name was Kiki. And when the colonel's dictatorship came to power, or seized power in Greece in 1974, Martin knew the country well and had been in, you know, there through his wife and all that. He cashed in his small navy pension and basically started working with the resistance to the junta. So years later, he became known to Peter Preston because Martin was also involved in Cyprus. While trying to do good things on the peace line in Cyprus and negotiate relations between both sides. And Peter just said to me, this guy's extraordinary. He's done so many things in life. If you're interested in talking to him, he lives in Malta. Go off and see him for a week or two. So I did. And I came back. And I said to Peter, this guy's incredible, extraordinary, and I'd love to write about it. And I'd like to write a book, at which point Preston sort of put his hands on his head and said, oh, God, you know, another book.
Not another one.
So it took a couple of years. I mean, one of the things that happened was Martin had become this businessman and the Soviet Union was opening up. And I went with him once to a place called Kamchatka. And if you play Risk, you would know on the Risk board that the extreme right of Siberia is a peninsula called the Kamchatka Peninsula. And the city there is called Petropavlovsk-Kamchatskaya. And Martin was trying to do business out there. And I flew out with him. And I mean, it was just bizarre. The whole Soviet Union was collapsing. Central power was gone. So at a local level, all these characters in the local Soviets were kind of selling off all the assets. I mean, this is where the oligarch came from. And there was a crowd called Kamchatka Lass. And Lass, I think, is Russian for forest or for wood. And this guy said, you know, Martin, you know. And he points out the window at, you know, this kind of mountainside the size of Wicklow, you know. And he says, you want to buy Lass? We sell you this, you know. Just weird stuff. And the other thing I remember from the city out there was, it was full of these kind of ex-communists who were trying to make money as fast as they could by selling off the assets. It was full of US evangelicals running around with Bibles, and it was full of hookers. And it was just like crazy, absolutely crazy. And sort of Russian warships down in the harbour. Anyway, I spent some while investigating Martin or interviewing him and following up, and wrote the book about the resistance to the colonel's dictatorship.
Closer to home, you went on the Camino. You had a few runs at it, but you did one, a lengthy expedition with your daughter, Natasha, and then you wrote a book arising from that. I mean, was that a spiritual exercise, or what motivated that particular trip?
Yeah, I think it was a spiritual exercise, or it certainly became that. Buen Camino is the book, and Buen Camino is what people say to you as you're walking along the road. You know, and it means, you know, have a good walk, enjoy it type thing. I grew up in a Church of Ireland family, so if in as much as I have a religious background, it is C of I. I see myself now as a kind of atheistic former prod. But doing the Camino was an extraordinarily moving experience. It is hugely enriching and uplifting, even if you don't believe in God, and I don't. I do feel spiritual. I feel spiritual about nature, about the outdoors, about the natural world and beauty and solitude and being contemplative in those settings. And when you're walking, your life takes on a different rhythm and a different pace, and you find yourself having very, very moving, serious conversations with people, because everybody who does the Camino almost invariably is doing it for a very specific reason.
I was going to do a chunk of it once and had the ticket bought. I think, was it to Santander or San Sebastian? I can't remember, but I decided not to go. And the reason I didn't was that Martin Sheen movie.
All right, yeah.
Because I said I couldn't bear the thought of having to meet fellas like that Dutch character along the way. I said, no, thanks. Yeah. Some other time, I'm going to stick to Donegal.
you do meet some people who are just like slightly you know, slightly unhinged or unpleasant. But then you just, you hold back on your walking, or you walk a bit faster and you get away with them. But mostly they're people who are, they're very thoughtful, and almost invariably they have had something in their life that's happened. They've been fired. They've got cancer and have recovered. Their best friend died. Their mother or father died. Their marriage fell apart. But there'll have been some sort of convulsive event in their life. And they want to do this to process their feelings about that.
And did you have a convulsive event?
I didn't actually. No, I did it. I mean, my interest was journalistic, really. Mm. I mean, I did it first on a motorbike and wrote about it in the Irish Times. And of course, that's not the way to do it at all. But talking to pilgrims, I thought these people are interesting. There's something here. And it was actually a young woman in the mountains of Galicia. And I asked her when I was on the motorbike, I said, you know, why are you doing this? And she said, and she paused and she kind of thought hard. And she said, I'm just sick of technology. I want to get away from technology. And I thought, that's interesting why somebody would feel that this is the way to escape that. And I wanted to go back and really get to know these people and really understand. So when I came home, I asked Natasha and she said, yeah. And we did from a place called León to Santiago. And that was about 2 or 3 weeks. And it completely and utterly blew us away. And at the end of it, we both said, we're going to do the whole thing and we're going to do it properly. Let's write a book together about it. So a little while later, we did that. We went to Saint-Jean in the Pyrenees and went all the way to Finisterre.
You mentioned motorbikes, Peter, which brings us to your most recent book, From Tip to Top. I mean, quite the adventure. And that's kind of that doesn't even begin to describe what you took on, really. The most southern part of Chile to the most northern part of Alaska. I mean, yeah. You didn't go a direct route, but you did over 40,000 kilometres, I think, on the motor. What got into you?
I've always been adventurous, and I think maybe I'm an odd mix of a loner, and I'm a gregarious loner, if such a thing exists. You know, I love people and I love other people and I love being with people. But I suppose I like doing it on my own terms. So I wanted to do this journey on my own so that my concentration would be on the landscape where I was, the towns, the villages I was going through, and the people I was meeting along the way. I like biking. I like being on the motorbike. It is a risky thing to do. There's no question about that. I'm reasonably experienced at this stage. I'm very experienced after having done 44,000 kilometres.
It was one horse of a bike, if I can put it like that.
It was one horse of a bike, yeah. And as you say, it's outside the building here. I got it home and I still use it. And it did all those kilometres without a single mechanical issue, which is extraordinary, I think. I went through 3 sets of tyres and I had 2 punctures. But the bike performed absolutely flawlessly.
You might as well mention the makers then.
I mean, I've no relationship with them, so I'm not getting anything for doing this. It is a BMW R1200 GS Adventure. It is a big horse of a bike. It's not really a bike for speed. It's a bike for endurance and for ruggedness, if you like. You're sitting up rather than lying over the tank and holding onto the forks and trying to do speed. You're more in command of the thing, and it's the robustness of the bike that appeals to me.
Yeah, and it was you, the bike, a tent, and a sleeping bag. That was the basic kit. And I suppose a few petrol cans down on the side.
A couple of petrol cans, yeah. One of which I lost in Colombia going over this rough road that put the hard crossways on me. But yeah, that was I brought way too much. I mean, the Camino taught me how to travel light because you carry everything you need. And I stupidly kind of forgot that lesson. I mean, I brought a pile of books with me and I had my laptop with me. And I had a shovel to dig a hole in the ground if I was caught short in the middle of nowhere and all that sort of thing, you know, and cooking stuff, and some of which I needed and some of which I didn't and was daft. And I, you know, I brought spare tubes for the tires and what have you. And that was silly. You know, I didn't need them. But yeah, I was on my own. I did a little bit of what they now call wild camping, but not too much. Mostly it was hostels, particularly in South America and Central America. In North America, it was almost every night was camping in state parks and national parks.
13 countries, I think, in South and Central America or thereabouts. And again, different cultures, different people, different regimes. I mean, what stood out for you, Peter? I mean, you wrote very descriptively and almost scarily about poverty, I think. Was that in Peru?
Yeah, it was almost all over. Not so much in Chile, or I'm sure there is poverty there, obviously, but I didn't see it. But it really hit you in the face in Peru and in Bolivia and in parts of Central America. And it wasn't even just the poverty. It was the inequality. It was, you could go to, say, in Lima. Lima's a wonderful city, beautiful city, the center of it, you know, all the old convents, the old cathedrals and what have you. And you think this is fabulous, and there's paved streets, and it's just lovely. And then out in the countryside, you can see people who are just very far below the poverty line. And when I was there, there was a certain amount of political unrest, and there were demonstrations and roadblocks and what have you. And I had to negotiate and navigate my way through. So I engaged with these people and found them lovely. You know, I have appalling pidgin Spanish, and they had even less English, but we were able to communicate. And the overwhelming characteristic about them was, yes, they were angry, and yes, they wanted a bit, but it was their poverty.
Yeah, and you've spoken as well about a technique, or at least an approach you had to maybe some of the more tricky moments, say, where you might have been meeting with figures of authority based on the advice you got from a Garda friend.
Yeah, another biker, the biker detective Ken McGreevy in Malahide, and his pal, John O'Kelly. And they're both very experienced, and have gone to a lot of out-of-the-way places. And John, in fact, was doing the Pan-American journey as well over some years, a couple of years back. And they gave me advice which kind of chimed with my instinct, but it was great to hear it from their experience. And it was, you know, if you get stopped or if you're in a situation where you're concerned, stop the bike, turn off the engine, take off your sunglasses, take off your helmet, get off the bike and walk up to whoever it is, a policeman, a protest or whatever it is, with your hand outstretched, you know, and say, buenos dias, amigo, you know, qué tal?
And a smile on your face.
Yeah, and a smile on your face, you know, and that will diffuse the situation. And it works. And, you know, I had a certain amount of that experience from my reporting days and riots in the north and riots in Dublin and what have you, that the last thing to do in a situation which is already a bit fragile is to make it more fragile. You're the one that needs to be calm, needs to be friendly. And they respond, you know, and the situation does ratchet down.
You met a few bizarre people and situations or encounter them along the way. I'm thinking particularly of the gun fair. Was it in Tucson, Arizona?
Yeah, Tucson, the annual Tucson Gun Fair Expo 2023. Yeah, I just saw, I think, on a lamppost a sign for it, and I thought, well, that's a must do. So I went along, and I mean, the first bizarre thing was the sign at the door, which said no guns allowed inside. And of course, inside, I mean, there were more guns than, you know, probably the defence forces have. I mean, there were just hundreds and hundreds of AR-10 and AR-15. The AR-15 is known as America's gun, because it's been involved in more mass killings of children.
And you decided really there's no talking to these guys about, you know, the morality of guns or mass shootings. I mean, you just kind of...
I would say there's no talking to them. I would talk to them and did and listened and all. But you do reach a point where you realise, I'm not going to convince this guy of anything. I mean, particularly one man I spoke to, and I went through the litany of... There had actually been a huge shooting in Texas just beforehand. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was another one of these shopping mall things, and I think half a dozen or more people were killed. And I said to this guy, you know, there isn't another country in the world that has this problem of regular mass shootings, regular school shootings. You know, why do you have this in America? And he looked at me and he said, that's because we got more freedom in America. And, you know, there's kind of no comeback to a comment like that. You realise that it's almost like the, what was that phrase years ago, men are from Mars and women are from Venus. You know, there's such a gulf of difference that it cannot be bridged.
Was it lonely? I mean, we did you go through moments where you said, God, what am I doing on this trip? were you homesick at any stage?
Yeah, I was. I was homesick for Maura at times. I missed her, and I missed particularly scenes of great natural beauty. Maura is a painter, and So there were, she's got a very good appreciation of colour and light and all of that. And there were some times when I was looking at something and I knew she would love this, and I wish that she had been there at those moments. But most of the time, if I did feel a bit lonely or a bit weary, I knew just get on the bike and, you know, go off again, because the next, around the next corner, there'll be something fascinating and interesting.
And of course, I was fascinated. I was rather amused to read this in one of your books. I am indebted finally to my wife, Moira, who has indulged me for far too long. Now, listeners might have expected that in the preface to Tip to Top, but in fact, it was written, dated London, October 1993, in the book about the Colonels. I said, you know, I mean, if you're writing that in 1993, I mean, how do you even begin to talk about how you've been indulged in the 30 years
you're
since?
You're an awful son. So for spotting that, it shows how long suffering she is. But she's hung in there. We're 34, coming up 35 years married. So
there really is. You talk about, you know, how do you come back from a line like that? You know, I mean, you're in the context of the gun sellers or the gun buyers. I mean, there it is. You know, finally, who has indulged me for far too long. I mean, you know, there has to be a big present somewhere along the line for a woman like that. What was it like coming back home after all of that solitude and homesickness?
Well, I suppose the coming back home itself was interesting because, you know, it had been over 200 days on the road and all of those kilometres. And I got back down to Vancouver, back down through Alaska, through the Yukon, British Columbia, because that was the best base to come home from. And I knew I had to air freight the bike home, so I had to sort that out. And once I had that sorted out, I was in the air freight company offices and I said, you know, have you got Wi-Fi here? Oh yeah, sure. And I said, can I use it? Yeah, sure. So I sat down on the floor, and it was a Tuesday morning at about 10:15, and I sat on the floor, got on the mobile phone, got on Skyscanner and looked for flights to Dublin. And there was one that afternoon at 3:30, Vancouver to Calgary, Calgary to Dublin, arriving the following morning at I think 10 or 10:30, and I hit the purchase button and I got the ticket and I sat there on the floor looking at this thing, saying, you know, Jesus Christ, I'm going home. And I had been due to meet a pal in Vancouver that afternoon for coffee, and I had to get on to him and say, look, Randy, I'm going home today. You know, can we bring forward the coffee to 11? And he said, yeah, sure. So I rushed into the city, had a cup of coffee with this pal, got back out to the airport, stepped on a plane and got home. And the only person who knew I was coming home for sure was Natasha, our daughter. And she picked me up from the airport. Moira was in Mayo at the time. And I got to Houston Station, got on the train and got to Westport and got into a taxi, went out to Lewisburg. And I walked into the house and Moira was there with some friends with her back to me. And one of the friends kind of stood up and pointed and was speechless. And she turned around and she sort of shrieked and said, oh, you bugger, I knew you'd do this. And we had a big hug and it was great.
It sounds like a case of they all lived happily ever before
and ever after, yeah.
Peter Murta, thank you so much indeed.
Thank you.
For joining us on the Insights podcast. Thank you for sharing your stories and your insights. To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.